yet another busy week for the Trump administration. Basically, the Sharknado of administrations, in that they are spinning out of control, destroying everything in their path.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. We're also heard up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, in Cottage Grove on Queso, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans' WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day of the week for your listening convenience on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Lot to cover today, lot of breaking news, including, let's see, Desi Doyen, I had just, wasn't it just late last week when Rand Paul was pretending. Remember, he was pretending he was not going to vote for CIA Director Mike Pompeo?
Yes, I
for
do
Secretary
recall
of State.
That.
And remember when I said, yeah, don't believe him. He always buckles, Rand Paul does. He always folds. He always stays with Donald Trump.
He always flip-flops at the very last minute. Yes, I do
he
recall you
saying
that.
He always pretends that he's going to do something. He's going to stand up to this president. He never does. As we go to air here today, it looks like the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has just now approved CIA Director Mike Pompeo's nomination to become Secretary of State. Rand Paul has folded, apparently decided that he would vote for Pompeo after all to be the Secretary of State, despite Pompeo's long support for foreign wars, for torture, despite the fact that Pompeo, as a congressman, spoke out against marriage equality, which is a rights issue that he will have to deal with around the world, despite the fact that, as you pointed out, Desi Doyen, I think last week on our Green News Report, or whenever that was, I've lost all track of time, Mike Pompeo is also a climate change denier.
Yes, he's a total full climate science denier. He'll moderate his views somewhat, I'm sure, in confirmation hearings, but no. He's not. He completely denies the science, and he doesn't believe that humans are have anything to do with it, and that there should be nothing that is done. And we're supposed to be leading the world, remember, in climate change action. You know, leading the Paris Climate Agreement at the United Nations and all that. So no,
we are leading the world. We're leading the world away from climate change action at this point. Also, as we go to air here, news just coming in. It looks like officials say 9 people were killed and 16 injured when a man driving a van plowed down pedestrians on a Toronto street. That's just coming in. Officials call this pure carnage. And back here in the U.S., the mentally unstable gunman who was suspected of opening fire at a Waffle House restaurant in the middle of the night on, what was it, Saturday night, Sunday morning, has now been arrested not far from his apartment. This was late on Monday after hiding from police for more than a day following the attack that killed 4 people. At that Waffle House and injured at least four others, authorities had mounted a massive manhunt for 29-year-old Travis Reinking after the Sunday morning attack in which a gunman clad only in a jacket used an AR-15 rifle to kill four and injure others. Metropolitan Nashville Police announced Monday on Twitter that Reinking was taken into custody after being spotted in a wooded area not far from where he lived in Nashville. When confronted, apparently he laid down on the ground. Officers cuffed him, according to a detective from Nashville PD. He said that Reinking carried a black backpack that had within it a silver semi-automatic weapon and 45 caliber ammunition when he was taken in. Reinking is described as a white man with brown hair. He opened fire with this AR-15 in the middle of the night in the Waffle House parking lot first, and then he stormed the restaurant shortly after 3 a.m. on Sunday. Four people were killed. Four others injured, as I said, before a quick-thinking customer wrestled the weapon away from the shooter, preventing more bloodshed. Reinking then managed to disappear into the night. Police say that about 20 people were in the Waffle House at the time of the shooting. They included people of varying races and ethnicities, but the four people who were killed were all minorities, three black and one Hispanic. In fact, it was a black man without a gun who confronted the shooter and stopped the shooting in order to save his own life and those of everyone else in that Waffle House. James Shaw Jr., 29-year-old restaurant patron who burned his hand grabbing the hot muzzle of the assault weapon as he wrestled it away from the gunman. He's a Nashville native who works as a wireless technician for AT&T. Shaw said he was no hero, despite being hailed as one by Nashville Mayor David Briley.
He shot through that door, I'm pretty sure, and I'm pretty sure he grazed my arm. And it was at that time that I kind of made up my mind, because there's no way to lock that door, that if it was going to come down to it, he was going to have to work to kill me. So at the time that he was either reloading or the gun jammed or whatever happened is when I ran through the swivel door. I hit him with the swivel door, and then the gun was kind of jammed up and it was pushed down. So we were scuffling, and I managed to get him with one hand on the gun, and then I grabbed it from him and I threw it over the countertop. And after that, I was trying to get out the door, and I think he was pretty much in the entranceway, so I just took him out with me, out of the entrance, and all the way outside. So on my Instagram and Facebook, everybody's calling me a hero, but I want people to know that I did that completely out of a selfish act. I was completely doing it just to save myself. Now, me doing that, I did save other people, but I don't want people to think that I was the Terminator or Superman or anybody like that. I figured if I was going to die, he was going to have to work for it. So I rushed him, and it actually worked out into my favor.
So that was James Shaw Jr., 29-year-old, who saved the day at the Waffle House and kept the carnage from being much worse than it already was. Not a good guy with a gun who saved the day. A good guy with a swivel door and a lot of guts to grab the gun. It wasn't an immigrant or a Muslim or even a black man who committed this latest gun massacre in the U.S. Once again, it was a white guy with ridiculously easy access to ridiculously lethal weapons. Meanwhile, authorities in Illinois shared past reports suggesting multiple red flags about this young man with paranoid delusions, 29-year-old accused shooter Travis Reinking. In May 2016, Reinking told deputies from Tazewell County, Illinois, that music superstar Taylor Swift was stalking him and hacking his phone, and that his family was also involved. Ryan King agreed to go to a local hospital at some point for an evaluation after repeatedly resisting the request from officials. Another sheriff's report said that Ryan King had barged into a community pool in Tremont, Illinois, last June, jumped into the water wearing a woman's overcoat. Investigators believe that he had an AR-15 rifle in his car trunk at that time, but it was never displayed, reportedly, and no charges were filed. Last July, Ryan King was arrested by the U.S. Secret Service after he entered a restricted area near the White House and refused to leave, saying that he wanted to meet President Donald Trump. Ryan King was reportedly not armed at the time of that arrest, but at the FBI's request, state police in Illinois revoked his state firearms card and seized four guns from him, according to authorities. Well, that's nice. Especially since multiple outlets reported on Monday that Ryan King had told Secret Service officers when he was arrested at the time that as a, quote, sovereign citizen who had he had a right to access the White House grounds. Sovereign citizens, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, believe that they, not judges, not juries or law enforcement or elected officials, get to decide which laws to obey and which ones to ignore. In a 2011 law enforcement bulletin, the FBI said that it considered the sovereign citizens to be extremists and comprising a domestic terrorist movement. And they counted six law enforcement officers who had been murdered by movement adherents since 2000. Nonetheless, when Ryan King was arrested at the White House by the Secret Service and identified himself as a sovereign citizen, apparently, while that was enough to notify officials in FBI and have this guy's guns taken away, apparently it wasn't enough to keep his father from being given those guns back. His sons, his 29-year-old son's four semi-automatic weapons were given back to the father for some reason. And then that AR-15 was one of those four weapons. An AR-15 was used in the shooting over the weekend. It was one of the firearms that was seized after the White House incident, and yet he was still available to use it. Ryan King's father has not acknowledged giving them back to his son, giving them back to his son. A federal official says the father could face charges for returning those guns. But why was the father given those guns back at all? And why was it so easy for a guy, a 29-year-old man, with clearly a record of trouble in his life, why was it so easy in this country for that man to buy four different semi-automatic weapons? Because these are the United States of America. I guess that's the answer. Adam Best, a progressive filmmaker, tweeted, "Disturbed white shooter opens fire on victims with AR-15 and would have killed more if he wasn't disarmed by an unarmed black hero." The Waffle House James Shaw Jr. story totally dismantles the right-wing fantasy that white good guys with guns are saving us from a minority hellscape. We'll open up the phones in a little bit to take your calls on anything and everything that we happen to talk about today. Our phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Late last week, we spent some time detailing how Republicans faced with a potential, I should say emphasis on potential, blue wave that may be coming at them this November are now attempting to undermine democracy itself any way that they can. Never mind trying to win elections the old-fashioned way by lying about stuff. And calling their opponents terrorists, though they continue to do both of those things as well. Never mind voter suppression to keep people from voting on election day however they can, though they continue to do that as well. Now they're trying to change the very way that elections are held in this country, or more specifically, prevent them from being held wherever and however they can. We've been talking in recent weeks about one episode after another of Republicans trying to prevent elections from happening at all as their fortunes seem to be turning south this year. That includes Scott Walker, Republican governor of Wisconsin, trying to prevent special elections, two special elections from being held to fill two state legislative seats in Republican districts. He does not want those elections to happen. Following a huge loss in a special election for state Senate last January in Wisconsin, which ended up flipping a long-held Republican seat in an area that had gone for Trump in 2016. That seat was flipped from red to blue, given the turnout, given the state of the nation right now. Scott Walker did not want to call those two new elections after three different judges, including one appointed by Walker himself, excoriated him for refusing to call a date for these two special elections. And the state legislature itself was trying to call an emergency legislative session to change the law itself. That's how much they really don't want to have elections as much as they can in the state of Wisconsin. Well, Walker eventually agreed to call the special elections when his court options pretty much ran out. That was in Wisconsin. In Arizona, the state legislature tried to sneak in an emergency provision to change state law to prevent Senator John McCain's Senate seat from being filled for some 2.5 years in case McCain is forced to vacate his Senate seat in the next month or so due to the brain cancer that he is currently battling. In Arizona, they tried to use this emergency provision to just change the law, but they were caught doing it. They were embarrassed, and none of the Democrats in the state legislature in Arizona agreed to it. And to pass this emergency measure, they would have had to have 2/3 support in both houses. So that was pulled back, but not for lack of trying by Arizona Republicans. And in Michigan, Republican Governor Rick Scott has simply refused to Rick Snyder has simply refused to call a special election to fill the seat that was vacated by Democratic Congressman John Conyers in Detroit, a very blue area, certain to go Democratic. Well, Rick Snyder is just not calling an election at all. We can fill that in November. That following Conyers' resignation last year after allegations of sexual misconduct. I think he actually left Congress before Trent Franks in Arizona, or at least it was right around the same time. But there's a special House election on Tuesday to fill Trent Franks' seat in Arizona, because the Arizona U.S. House special election law requires one to happen, and because the Republican governor there, Governor Ducey, probably thinks that it's going to be filled by a Republican. We'll see if he's right about that after polls close on Tuesday. But it's even worse than that in Michigan, not calling this election. We very closely on this show in late 2016 and 2017 covered the attempted but ultimately failed effort by Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein to seek hand recounts after the stunning 2016 presidential election. She tried to get hand recounts in Michigan, in Wisconsin, and in Pennsylvania, wherever paper ballots happen to be available in Pennsylvania. But the case in Michigan, where Trump is said to have won the state in 2016 in a shocking upset by just over 10,000 votes out of more than 5 million cast, that was especially egregious in that Republicans, they went to court and were successfully able to shut down the hand count that had begun in the state after Stein had raised and forked over about $1 million for attempted citizen oversight of that shocking election where a Republican had not won in almost 30 years for president. But she was not allowed to carry out that recount despite her willingness to pay for it, to have it done. It was blocked by the state courts. And now state legislators in Michigan are trying to make sure that such an attempt to ensure ballots are counted accurately, they are trying to work to make sure that never happens again. political candidates who lose big will not be able to seek a recount under this legislation that is nearing Michigan Governor Rick Scott's desk. The Republican-led Senate voted 27-8 last week for legislation upping the standards for election recounts to require that aggrieved candidates prove they have a reasonable chance of victory in such a count. Remember, they have to do this before they are allowed to pay for their own hand count under this. They would have to prove it. The House also voted 93-16 to pass this legislation to double losing candidates' fees to recount votes if they lost more by more than 5 percentage points. So they're making it harder in every way they can for there to be citizen oversight, for a candidate who has questions about the results, for voters who have questions about the results, to find out if the computers that counted the hand-marked paper ballots across the state of Michigan actually counted them accurately. Those bills will soon go to the governor. Currently, candidates must allege that they believe that they are aggrieved due to fraud or mistake in order to petition for a recount. Republican State Rep. Jim Lilly, who's a sponsor of the bill that passed the Senate, said that his legislation was born of the 2016 elections, what he describes as the drawn-out aftermath in Michigan, where Jill Stein triggered a recount after Donald Trump's stunning defeat of Hillary Clinton by 10,704 votes out of more than 5 million cast. Lilly said, "The last election cycle just brought to light something with our election law in Michigan that could be exploited. I didn't want to see somebody taking advantage of that again," said Lilly. So it didn't bring to light to him how terrible Michigan recount laws were. It didn't bring to light to him that some 60,000 votes in Detroit alone were not allowed to be recounted at all, even before they stopped the court-ordered stoppage of the count there, thanks to Michigan's arcane law that prevents the hand tally of ballots at all, if the number of ballots differs from the number of signatures in the poll books by even one vote. They weren't even allowed to look at some 60,000 of those votes because the number was slightly off, the number of ballots in the box versus the number of signatures in the book. Therefore, they weren't allowed to count them. Whatever was counted by the computers on election night is what would stand.
Okay, say that one more time.
Which part?
The number of ballots did not match.
Right. If the number of ballots that they counted in the ballot box that were delivered on election night, let's say there was 200 ballots that were brought in that night.
Okay.
But only 199 people or 201 people had signed into the books. That means no hand count at all.
No checking
at all. They can't. The candidate cannot. Well, they can ask for a recount, but they will not get it. Whatever
wow.
they recorded, whatever the computers recorded on election night, that's it. That's going to stand. There will be no change. And that was under the existing law. And instead of fixing that, they're making it even harder for there to be any kind of citizen oversight. So, you know, it's incredible that this is what it brought. This is what this is the response that Michigan lawmakers had to what happened in 2016 with their crappy election system and their impossible to recount system. They're making it they're raising the bar to even higher for actual citizen oversight of our election results. According to AP, Stein's efforts ultimately escalated into a legal tangle with a state appeals court that terminated the recount upon ruling that her 1% share of the vote does not qualify her as, quote, aggrieved. So this new bill in the Michigan Senate would codify the judge's order on Stein's recount, which Lilly described as, quote, clearly frivolous. So asking for a hand count when there was just a 10,000 vote margin out of millions of vote casts in Michigan, that is, quote, clearly frivolous as they see it in the state of Michigan. Despite one of the most shocking presidential election results in American history, a state that hadn't gone Republican in a presidential race for decades, almost 30 years, that was clearly frivolous. Senator Lilly, really? Democratic Senate Minority Leader in Michigan, Jim Ananick, I think that's how you say his name, he voted no for this bill because he believes all candidates should have the right to pursue a recount if they're willing to pay the cost. He said, I fundamentally don't like limiting people's access. He is a Democrat from Flint, Michigan, where they know a thing or two about what it's like to lose one's democracy. Jill Stein's recount showed, showed mistakes and have led to improvements in our election process. Those things would not have come out if the recount hadn't happened, even that partial recount that was allowed before the Republicans went to court to stop it dead in its tracks. Stein's Michigan recall campaign spurred widespread confusion over irregularities that were found in over one-third of Detroit precincts. Since then, Michigan's Secretary of State has announced there will be manual election results. Those are set to debut this year in this year's midterm elections. We'll see how those go. Wisconsin, in the meantime, another state chosen in the 2016 election for a recount by Jill Stein. They have already passed laws restricting future requests, making it harder there. The count was allowed to be completed in Wisconsin, but not by hand. Counties could choose to simply run the same paper ballots through the same computers that counted them in the first place, and then call that a recount.
I'm noticing a running theme here that that Republicans in these state legislatures are erecting barriers to recounts. They're erecting barriers to voting. It's like they don't want you to recount your elections and they don't want you to vote.
Isn't that odd?
Yeah. So it again underscores that it really does matter to pay attention who is in your state legislature.
Two more quick points here I want to get to before we get to our break, and then we'll come back. We can talk about, whatever you want to talk about. I was hoping to get to some special counsel Robert Mueller news, some Donald Trump news, whether he's going to be indicted, impeached, all sorts of things. You can give us a call on that or anything else, or this 818-985-5735 is our phone number. But let me hit this first because, all right. Let's start here on this one. That's how the GOP rolls when it comes to elections and stopping them from happening. They're against them. But when it comes to voting, at least for some people, well, they are against that as well, at least certain people when they try to vote, as another new story out today reminds us. But first, to give this context, let me go back to just last month, late in March, when, according to the Fort Worth Star Telegram in Tarrant County, Texas, a judge late in March sentenced 43-year-old Crystal Mason to 5 years in prison for voting illegally in the 2016 presidential election while she was on supervised release from a 2011 fraud conviction. Her defense attorney told the court that she was never told that she couldn't vote and she voted in good faith. Why should she risk going back to prison for something that is not going to change her life? Mason is an African-American woman. She is just one of more than 6 million felons in the U.S., according to a report released in 2016 by the Sentencing Project, who are barred from voting. Nearly 500,000 in Texas alone were ineligible to vote in 2016. Crystal Mason apparently had no idea that after she had served her time as a felon, she got a 3-year sentence. She had served just shy of that those 3 years. She had no idea that she was not allowed to vote. She was in prison because she had helped clients receive improper refunds as a tax preparer. And during her testimony, she told the court that she was assigned a provisional ballot after she arrived at her usual polling place and discovered her name was not on the voter rolls. Mason said she was told by the federal court that her her supervision officer, the election workers, or the U.S. district judge who had sentenced her in her fraud case, none of those people, she said, or those courts or those judges, none of them told her that she would not be able to vote in elections once she got out of prison until she finished serving her sentence including supervised release. Sacrificing her freedom to vote was not something that she would knowingly do, Mason told the judge at her trial. Mason said, I inflated tax returns. I was trying to get more money back for my clients. I admitted that. I owned up to that. I took accountability for that. I would never do that again. She said, I was happy enough to come home and see my daughter graduate. My son is about to graduate. Why would I jeopardize that? Not to vote. She said, I didn't even want to go vote. Her mother convinced her she should go vote. After the hearing on this, Mason was taken straight to jail after the conclusion of her trial. And a chorus of small children could be heard seen waving and heard saying, bye bye, Big Mama. Mason testified that she had remade herself since a release from prison, including she got a degree in a new field. She got a new job. She had gone to vote at her mother's insistence, brought her driver's license as identification, according to her testimony. And when poll workers could not find her name on the list of registered voters, Mason said she was given a provisional ballot and she was coached through how to fill out the affidavit process by a poll worker who did not inform her she could not vote. That case, she got 5 years in prison. This 43-year-old black woman. 5 years in prison for voting unknowingly, voting illegally. That case followed another in Tarrant County, Texas, where 37-year-old Rosa Maria Ortega, mother of four who had a green card, she drew national attention for this case because she was convicted of voting illegally in 2012 in the general election and then in the 2014 Republican primary runoff because she thought as a permanent resident, she's been here for years, she thought that she was allowed to vote with a green card as a permanent resident. She, this immigrant, she received a sentence of 8 years in prison for voting, despite not knowing that she was not allowed to do so. So the African-American woman, she goes to jail for 5 years for casting one vote. The Hispanic immigrant goes to jail for 8 years for voting twice. In both cases, the women believe they were allowed to do so, which brings us to what happened in Tarrant County today. To a Tarrant County judge, a justice of the peace, a white judge, in case that matters, for whom the law seems to be very different than it does for those two other women. Justice of the Peace Russ Casey pleaded guilty Monday to tampering with a government record and resigned after an investigation showed that he turned in fake signatures to secure a place on the March 6 Republican primary ballot. The embattled judge who worked in Northeast Tarrant County, Texas, was sentenced to 2 years in jail, but that was probated over 5 years. In other words, he was given 5 years probation and will not have to serve one day in jail for purposely faking signatures to put himself on the ballot as a candidate for this year's election. The type of election fraud that a former felon or an immigrant with a green card might have, you know, knowingly cast one single vote in such an election. One single vote, they go to jail for 5 years and 8 years. This guy fakes, we don't know how many, dozens and dozens of signatures in order to get on the ballot at all to become a judge and make, $125,000 a year as an elected official, as a judge. He gets off with a slap in the wrist. 5 years probation, won't have to serve one day in jail for any of that. He said, I apologize to the citizens of Tarrant County, the Tarrant County Republican Party, my family and friends for the way that I have ended my judicial career. He said, I ask for forgiveness and respect for our privacy, our family and friends, as our privacy as we go through this transition. Well, at least he gets to go through that transition with his family and friends instead of in prison. By the way, all he had to do was get 250 signatures. He's been an elected judge in Tarrant County since 2007. But when others began to question the signatures, finding them to have been faked, he withdrew his candidacy. The case was then turned over to law enforcement. The investigation determined that many of the signatures on the petition that Casey submitted were false and that Casey had signed the form saying that he witnessed all the signatures, according to the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. So this guy knew what he was doing as a judge and was fraudulently attempting to place himself on the ballot for a state job that pays $125,000 a year. And yet he's largely off the hook. District Attorney Sharon Wilson of Tarrant County said, "No one is above the law in Tarrant County. But I guess some get to skirt accountability more than others, it seems, even in the same county, and even after having a record of being in trouble before, this judge did. Last year, Casey was reprimanded for having an improper sexual relationship with a former clerk by the State Commission on Judicial Conduct. Casey, whose term was set to expire in January of 2019, had even filed a lawsuit seeking that his GOP challengers in this primary, in this March primary, trying to get them thrown off the ballot for, wait for it, an invalid number of signatures on their candidacy petitions. By the way, there is no Democrat seeking the post in November for Justice of the Peace. For some reason, in Tarrant County. So the guy who won the Republican, who won the primary in March, he will be the new Justice of the Peace there. When asked about Casey's sentence in comparison to the sentences that the African-American woman, Crystal Mason, had received after voting while on probation, not knowing that she was not allowed to, and that Rosa Maria Ortega, the green card holder who didn't know she wasn't allowed to vote, after being asked about that, the prosecutor, Matt Smid, noted that, well, Casey pled guilty. I guess the other women didn't. Casey pled guilty rather than going to trial. He, quote, accepted accountability for what he did. I guess that's the difference. Accountability? Not much, I guess, at least if you're a Republican white guy in power. Add all of that to the contempt of court charge, for example, this second one that we talked about late last week, issued by a federal George W. Bush appointed judge against Kansas Republican Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who, despite being slapped twice with contempt of court during trials regarding his attempts to keep 30,000 Kansans from voting because they didn't offer proof of citizenship papers when registering to vote, Kobach is still considered the front runner to become the next governor of the state of Kansas. What do you have to do to be a powerful white Republican in charge in this country to face any real accountability? That, even as Donald Trump was tweeting over the weekend to Michael Cohen, trying to say, oh, he's a wonderful fan. He's got a wonderful family. I could never see him flipping. Flipping? Flipping for what? Flipping against Donald Trump? Yeah, apparently so. Apparently, Donald Trump did something that he thinks someone might flip about. We'll see if we have time for that after this break. I know I'm running insanely late. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. This is what happens after a busy weekend. 818-985-KPFK. We'll take a quick break and we're back for more. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Let me get to some of your calls. I'm running way late. Again, as usual, 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Let's go to Gigi in Pasadena. Hey, Gigi, welcome to the Bradcast.
Hi, Brad. Love you to death.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm going to talk about your first step about the guy that killed the people at the Waffle House.
Yep.
I believe. You know what? I find it, my comment is, and I also find that you covered it beautifully, very well. But I would just add, and isn't it interesting that these guys go in, the white guys do these mass killings. The cops get to them, finally. Now, they know that they've already committed murders, and they know what they're capable of. Mm-hmm. I find it extraordinary that every time they manage to take them alive.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that I want any more deaths.
No.
I don't want anyone to get it twisted. But every time, on the other hand, they stop a black guy.
Yep.
And everything, probably 8 out of 10, maybe 7 out of 10.
Yep.
Maybe 8 or 9 out of 10, just for stopping to check or you made an illegal turn or something, they managed to end up with 12 and 25 bullets.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're driving while black with your taillight out, you will end up dead. But in this case, go massacre four people, shoot another four with an automatic rifle at a Waffle House in the middle of the night, and you'll be taken in peacefully by the police, apparently.
Every time. Yep. Every time. Love you, babe.
Thank you. Love you back. Appreciate that, Gigi. Let me go to 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Let's hit Morris in Long Beach. Hey, Mo, how are you, sir?
Hey, I love you, Brad. Listen, but we all need to understand that Americans, we feel that it's better to have our rights to guns than our rights to health care. That's just how we roll. A sociologist by the name of Jackie Orr once said that American society, our civil society, is psychologically organized, Brad, for the production of violence. To that I say, no kidding. And lastly, I want to say, there's a book called White Protestant Nation. I forget the guy's name, and I read the thing. You know, when Bush won in 2000, do you know they stopped that recount down there? They stopped recount.
Oh, yeah.
And one answer. Oh,
yeah, and a lot of people think more. A lot of people think, that's George W. Bush ended up winning, had more votes. No, they stopped the we were never allowed to have the hand count in the state of Florida, the presidential hand count, despite the fact that the final margin ended up being, what was it, 347 votes?
Tight.
Yeah. And even then, we weren't allowed to actually count actual ballots. And they pretend today that, oh, we couldn't count them. They were just impossible to read because of the swinging chads, the hanging chads. No, they were perfectly readable. George W. Bush clan went to the Supreme Court to prevent those ballots from being counted. Yeah.
It makes Scalia a hero. And by the way, Brad, say something about the Social Democratic Party. That's the third party that's coming up. They went from like 5,000 to 15,000, which is nothing in a country, 340 million. But, and it's got to be a millennial party. But anyway, I don't know much about it. Maybe you do. And go ahead and post bail for Mr. Cohen. Get him out of jail and let him represent the people in fighting those evil guys, because he's the only guy that really knows where all the bodies are dead.
Michael Cohen. All right. Thanks, Morris. I appreciate that. And, of course, you are welcome to talk about the Social Democratic Party or any other party you want. All I'm trying to do is make sure that everyone gets to vote, no matter what party it's for, and that their votes are counted, and they are counted accurately, and they're counted accurately in a way that we know that they are counted accurately. All right, I told you I was running late, so let me do this. Let me get out and take a quick break, and we'll get back to some of your calls. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We haven't even talked about embattled Missouri Governor Eric Greitens now facing a second felony charge, and he's still refusing to resign and leave. Is that going to give us some sort of idea what happens if and when Robert Mueller ever charges Donald Trump with anything or issues a report saying, hey, yeah, he committed felonies? Eric Greitens is just saying, it's the liberal media. It's a witch hunt out to get me. We'll try to get to that after this break. 818-985-5735. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Welcome back to your Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, very quickly here. Scandal-plagued Republican Missouri Governor Eric Greitens was charged with a second felony on Friday night, this one for allegedly illegally obtaining a donor list from a charity and using it for fundraising efforts in his gubernatorial campaign. Missouri's Attorney General Josh Hawley said in a statement following the new charge that these are serious charges and an important reminder that no one is above the law in Missouri. Like all criminal defendants, Governor Greitens is presumed innocent under the law until proven guilty. The computer tampering charge came after Hawley had announced earlier in the week that investigators had discovered the evidence that Greitens obtained the donor list from the veterans charity that he ran,
one called The Mission Continues. Greitens was elected governor in Missouri as a Republican in 2016. Greitens denies any wrongdoing. Of course he does, but that's the least of his problems. A grand jury had previously indicted Greitens back in February with an invasion of privacy charge for allegedly taking a nude photo of a woman with whom he was having an affair in 2015 and trying to use it to blackmail her. When he took that photo, he had allegedly tied her up in the basement of his house, took her clothes off, snapped the photos, and threatened that he would release them if she ever told anybody. The woman also recently offered graphic testimony to Missouri state lawmakers about what happened, claiming that Greitens had slapped her when she told him that she had had sex with her own husband and forced her into sexual acts against her will, even as she sobbed uncontrollably during all of this. That's according to the report from the Republican-controlled Missouri legislature. The governor has admitted to the affair, but has denied the woman's allegations of blackmail, violence, sexual coercion. Attorney General Hawley, a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate to run against Democrat Claire McCaskill this November, and other prominent Republicans in the state have called for Greitens to resign as they worry about the embattled governor and how that could weigh down the entire party this November in Missouri. Greitens has nonetheless refused to step aside and insists that the allegations made about him are all part of a witch hunt. Does that sound familiar to you? That's exactly what Donald Trump has been doing, claiming that this is all a witch hunt by the liberal media. That's what Greitens has been saying. We have been viciously attacked by the liberal media and their allies, and apparently their allies include the Republican state attorney general and Republican lawmakers in the state house in Missouri. That's what Greitens told, talking about the vicious attacks by the liberal media and their allies. That's what he told a Republican Lincoln Day dinner in Texas County, Missouri on Saturday night after this second felony charge. And after all of these Republicans are calling for him to resign. Are you kidding me? So is this a preview of how Donald Trump would behave if he were indicted with felonies at this point and or impeached by the U.S. House? You know, none of that stepping down gracefully as Richard Nixon did with these guys, seemingly. Charge them with felonies. They're going to hang in there as long as they possibly can. I've talked about that point, and I know there's a lot of folks. So let me get to your calls. I'll just point you back to my one of my interviews last week with Randall Eliason, former U.S. Assistant Attorney. Former Assistant U.S. Attorney. There we go. About whether Donald Trump can or cannot be indicted, whether Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein would allow an indictment, or if an indictment might come down that can't be prosecuted right now but might be prosecuted later on after Trump is out of office one way or another. I'll just point you to bradblog.com. You can download that fascinating interview with Randall Eliason on all of those points. But these folks don't go easily. Not anymore. Let me go to Kim in Pasadena. Hey, Kim, welcome to the broadcast.
Yes, thank you, Brad. I don't have anything specific. I'm just calling to commend you on your great research and muckraking. I hope you continue to expose these phonies and frauds and keep up the good work. It's very much appreciated out here in the trenches.
Thank you, Kim. I really appreciate that call as well. Very kind of you to say. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Let's go to Nicole in Los Angeles. Hey, Nicole, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Brad. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good.
Oh, good.
I'm good. I'm calling because I just wanted to make just like a really quick comment about the shooter at the Waffle House.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that the minute that the news broke and I kept reading and hearing about it, right away I knew that this white guy had killed, like, mostly black people, because they never, ever tell you when it's a black person, black was, but being the victim, they never mentioned that. And so I just wanted to thank KPFK for just, you know, being around and being forthcoming and just reporting the facts. And this is really sad because, like, corporate news, it's not just fake news. It's either no news or partial news.
Yeah.
And so I find that extremely frustrating. And that's just another form of structural racism, you know, within this country. And so I'm just, like, really thankful for you guys.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We're thankful for you, as are not just KPFK, but all of the stations that carry the broadcast all across the country, trying to counter the stuff and nonsense that seems to take up so much of our corporate media. So I'm glad it's appreciated, Nicole, and I really appreciate your calling in with that thought. Thank you. 818.
Thank you.
You bet. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Barbara Bush, as you know, former First Lady, was laid to rest over the weekend. We're now getting breaking word just seconds ago here that former President George H.W. Bush has been hospitalized in intensive care just days after the funeral of his wife. I don't have more details than that. That is just breaking from several different sources, including CNN and Fox News. So there you go. And speaking of the Bushes, and good point, Des writes here on my screen here, we were talking about the Florida 2000 attempted recount that was stopped by the Republicans, George H.W. Bush's son, George W. Bush, who went to the Supreme Court to prevent ballots from being counted at all in the state of Florida. Des reminds me here that back in 2000, after that aborted count, there was a media consortium who went and recounted the ballots after it was too late to do anything about it, actually hand counted ballots across the state and found that no matter how you had counted them, no matter what standards you had used to count hanging chads, swinging chads, anything else, had all of the ballots across the entire state of Florida been counted, that Al Gore, in fact, would have won the state and the presidency along with it back in 2000. And, you know, I'm hoping there is a media consortium out there trying to do the same thing, to make public records requests for the ballots in Wisconsin, Michigan, and where they exist in Pennsylvania, where there's not many of them because they use mostly 100% unverifiable touchscreen systems in Pennsylvania. But I'm hoping that someone out there is attempting to preserve those ballots from 2016 beyond the 22-month federal deadline that they must be kept, so that maybe someday we can find out who actually did win in 2016. Wouldn't that be nice to know? Let me go to Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hello, sir. I just want to commend you on all your hard work. I'm in media. I know how much preparation goes into what you do. Real Thank quickly, under the New York venue, elections have consequences, is your mantra, which we all appreciate. So Mayor Bloomberg apparently has offered to, I guess, equalize the amount that we pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And so I'm just wondering if that will ever be challenged, and if so, if the stolen Gorsuch seat would be an influence, if it ever went that far on that ruling, he's able to put up that kind of money.
Well, you know, yeah, and it's billions of dollars, so I would actually be surprised. I hadn't read that about Bloomberg being willing to pay some amount of money. The money that we're talking about, I think, goes into a green fund. I can't get details. Des is on the phone here. But the fund that Des, that we pay, that the U.S. is supposed to pay in the Paris Climate Accord, is that for a green fund to help developing countries?
It's an international, it's called the Green Climate Fund, basically. And it is the developed countries, rich countries, since, you know, we are the ones that are primarily responsible for the majority of historical emissions, and that poor countries, developing countries, have not been responsible for that. Therefore, we should assist them in developing new technologies, in developing renewable energy so they can skip over the polluting fossil fuel phase of development that contributes to the problem. So, yeah, we're supposed to be donating all of this money to this fund. Other nations are doing that. The European Union is trying to take up the slack. That sounds like that's what Bloomberg is doing.
And
as
our
well.
Caller, Michael, yeah, it says that Bloomberg would be paying the U.S.'s part. That seems like too much money. I don't even think Bloomberg has that much money.
He's
does he?
Not. It's actually $4.5 million. So it's
that's
not,
it?
That's it for now. That's what he's only donating $4.5 million, and that's only to cover some of the U.S. commitment.
That's, okay, that's what he's putting in. That's not the putting. U.S. commitment
no,
itself
is not
much
the US.
Larger.
No, it's like a, I forget yeah. how much it is, but yeah, it's in the billions yeah. that we're supposed to be giving.
Thanks. Hey, Michael, does that answer your question or comment, sort of?
Yeah, yes, sir, absolutely. I'm just wondering if the biased liberal media is going to commend him because, of course, the conservatives always want to commend private citizens to step up to do these things. So I haven't heard anything about it.
There you go. Yeah, no, I didn't even know about the report, so I appreciate you letting me know. We will look into that, no doubt, for a future broadcast. Michael, I appreciate your call. And everyone else who I could not get to, my apologies. But thank you for calling in. We will be back with you again tomorrow for another thrilling broadcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my soundboard operator, D'Angelo Jones, today, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can drop me email as well. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. That is it. Until we meet again tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.